and welcome to the Open Systems Media eCast titled Parallelize, Load Balance, and Performance Tune Your Multicore Design. I'm Kurt Schwader, your moderator, with today's speaker, Rob O'Shanna from Freescale Semiconductor. Today's schedule consists of a 50-minute presentation, leaving about 10 minutes at the end of the hour for audience Q&A. Before we begin, I'd like to run through some features of your audience console. First is the Enlarge Slides button. This button will maximize the slides to fill your entire screen. The Download Slides button allows you to download and print the slides if you'd like a hard copy to follow along with. The button labeled Forward to a Friend enables you to send an email to someone that will include a registration link to this eCast so they can also attend. The Ask a Question text box enables you to participate in today's event. You simply type your question into the box and submit it using the Submit button. You can submit questions at any time during the presentation, and we encourage you to do so early and often while you're looking at the material in question and it's fresh in your mind. We'll address as many of these questions as we can during the closing Q&A. If you have a question pertaining to the eCast operation itself, you can submit those too, and one of our technicians will be happy to respond to you. Finally, this eCast will be posted online within 24 hours, and an audio podcast will also be made available. We'll talk about this more at the end of the Q&A. Today's speaker is Rob O'Shanna. He's the Director of Global Software R&D for Networking and Multimedia at Freescale and is a distinguished member of the technical staff. He has over 25 years of experience in real-time embedded, both in application and tools technology development. He is also a senior member of IEEE with an adjunct professor at SMU, where he teaches various courses in software engineering and is widely published in the field. He also has over 100 publications and presentations, most of them in the embedded systems area. I think you're in a real treat today. We'll hand it over to Rob, and you can get started.
Okay, thanks, Kurt. Welcome, everybody. It's good to be here. Let's get started. We have a lot of material, so the agenda. We'll talk about the multi-core programming landscape, and then we'll get into different phases of the multi-core development process, including exploration, verification, performance tuning. Then we'll talk a little bit about some specific multi-core processors, and then wrap up with some Q&A. So first of all, just a brief introduction, what's driving the multi-core adoption. Many of you are probably familiar with some of these trends. But basically, you know, first of all, the increase in just overall connectivity in many of our devices is driving more compute power. Reduced power consumption is an obvious one as well, trying to go towards more cores running at lower frequencies that drives overall system power consumption reductions. Other new areas evolving, some of which I'm spending some time on now, including cloud services, and then just overall consolidation. Size is a major driver in multi-core adoption, so even before multi-core, there was a desire to put more capability in smaller spaces. We'll talk about that as we go through this presentation. A lot of consolidation of services into unified devices is also is being done to drive lower bill of materials costs and things like this. So there's a lot of forcing functions, if you will, to take us down this path. Now, if you go to the next slide, what's the problem with Moore's Law? Well, obviously transistor counts are growing, but we're reaching some power ceilings. We can't just keep turning up the clock on these single core processors. We don't want to start melting things. And also, even some of the other industry technology trends over the last decade or so, like ILP, instruction-level parallelism, that's starting to plateau as well as far as the efficacy of doing more and more computing on smaller devices. And so the free lunch of just turning up the core performance is starting to really end, and we have to start looking at other technologies in order to deal with this problem. So one is multi-core. So is there opportunity here? Yeah, there is. If you go to the next slide here, opportunity abounds. Yeah, there is a lot of applications. that are doing multi-core type processing today. For example, symmetric multi-processing has actually been around for quite some time. This chart here shows some different applications that are popular in this space now. But the interesting thing is, look at the core utilization. It's kind of shocking to see how few of these programs really take advantage of all the cores and load balance appropriately to get maximum enablement out of these cores and entitlement from a performance perspective. So how do we go about actually getting more here? And there's some techniques we'll talk about. There's a lot of opportunity here. If you look at that one QuickTime HD application, that's actually one that's looking pretty good. That seems to be load balanced pretty well. Basically, we have some, just by looking at the data here, you can see that we've got a few challenges. Software is not quite kept up with the hardware, and we have to apply different techniques, different tools, different processes in order for us to begin to take advantage of this extra power we're now getting with multi-core. Okay, so moving on, how do we regain some of this software performance growth? This is just, again, a simple chart showing as we go from one core to four cores and then even to up to 32 cores and beyond. Amdahl's law can work for us, although there are limitations as far as the amount of sequential code that would limit how well we can do as far as scalability across multiple cores. We are looking for techniques and processes to allow us to exploit to the best possible way multi-core. And given that many of the applications today are sequential, it's that kind of migration path that many people are asking about in the education of how do we, what is the process, what are the techniques for getting there, because partitioning the system in properly onto multiple cores in some cases could actually be worse than running it on a single core. Okay, so moving on, there's parallelism in many forms. I just wanted to quickly do a survey here to show you what is out there and how this trend of parallelism has been here with us for a long time and will continue just in different forms. I talked already about instruction-level parallelism. We think there's a diminishing returns there as well, whether it's VLIW or other forms of instruction-level parallelism. Still very useful, very powerful, but we need to go to that next step. Even simultaneous multi-threading, this is just a technique for improving the overall efficiency of superscalar CPUs that support hardware multi-threading. It's been around for a while as well, but there are some challenges there too, and there's some limits. So we need to go beyond that. SIMD, single instruction, multiple data, again, been around for some time. Good at certain operations where you have multiple narrow data elements. You can actually go do a number of parallel operations on these vectors and get good performance from a data parallelism perspective. And then moving on to the next slide, even things like graphical processing units that do massive data parallelism today are good. They're programmable. In some cases, they're challenging to program, in a certain segment, they offer pretty good advantages today. Moving into the area where we spend a lot of our time now in multi-core, symmetric and asymmetric multi-core processing using homogeneous cores or heterogeneous cores, and then one or more operating systems are a lot of the programming models today in multi-core are oriented around symmetric and asymmetric multi-processing. And so this will continue to be popular today as far as the form of parallelism that that we're using to attack some of these big challenges. Now it's how do we make it work from a software perspective? How do I take advantage of these different forms and make my software work and partition and optimize well? So moving on, there's some architectural examples. I'll just mention a couple of these, but it's useful to at least show a couple examples. This one here shows an 8-core 4080 device. These are 8 power architecture cores in a symmetric multiprocessing type of an orientation, shared memory, coherent caches, and then where needed, just like any SoC today, accelerators to help with certain offloads, whether it's network processing or a wireless stack. Accelerators are always part of the solution. So we have the 4080. On the right, the Converge, which is more of a asymmetric multiprocessing architecture running different operating systems on a DSP, on a power architecture core. Just showing you a couple different examples here. The challenge on an AMP, the cores could be programmed by different groups, so how do you bring all this together into a system integration that gets the right levels of system performance that you're looking for? So just a couple different types of architectures, many of them in the industry today kind of look and feel similar, but this is just showing you a couple specifics that offer the kind of SMP and AMP type of programming paradigms. That's not good enough sometimes. You need to accelerate some things. So on the next slide, this is an example of what is kind of bolted onto the 4080, and that's a data path acceleration architecture. This is a set of accelerators that can be called from the cores that do certain offloads, whether it's cryptographic or pattern matching. They're there to help accelerate the common functions, to accelerate key traffic flows, or to just make things ultimately eliminate some of the performance bottlenecks. Accelerators can be used for things like this. And then the interconnect there in the middle is what's needed to be able to shuttle traffic between the cores and the accelerators. This is also, you want to make sure this is also not a bottleneck in the use of the interconnect. That's a design challenge that, again, we won't talk about it here today, but it's the whole SoC has to be balanced appropriately in order to get the maximum performance. Also, we can look at some software technologies like on the next slide, the virtualization is something that I'm just going to touch on, but there's a lot of interest now in the embedded space and in other areas on the use of virtualization technology. Virtualization is really just a simulation of software and or hardware. And then on top of that, you run other software applications. That simulation environment is usually called the virtual machine. And in the multi-core world, the goal is to design, if you're going to use virtualization for like a consolidation where maybe you want to take multiple applications that run on multiple servers and combine them into one device, that's a consolidation play. You can also do things like dynamic resource allocation or even sandboxing an application into its own partition so that, and protect it and prevent it from having an impact on other applications that are running. These are various use cases for virtualization. And the idea is to make sure you design a system that has the right hardware support for virtualization as well as the right software infrastructure that will allow you to, run these use cases on top of the virtual machine, on top of the hypervisor, and still get the performance and the capability you're looking for. A lot to say about this, but I'll just mention it now, and as we move on, we can come back to it a little bit later on. So if you combine the kind of the use cases for the different types of parallelism that we could deal with today, there's two that I'm going to use an example to talk through. That's task parallelism and data parallelism. You can, both of these could coexist on the same multi-core processor. As you see here on the left, task parallelism basically means we can allocate a group of cores for something like maybe a networking control plane where the tasks are doing different types of, it's a kind of an SMP, Linux might be running across all three cores doing different types of management functions, and error reporting and configuration functions on the task parallelism kind of partition. And then on the right, data parallelism, where you may have multiple cores and each of those cores is dedicated to processing certain types of data flows like TCP or UDP or what have you, each core running in parallel. That could be a bare board type of an environment with either no operating system or even a real-time operating system. Mainly, it's all about throughput, and we can design systems to take advantage of, again, both data parallelism and task parallelism. I'll show you an example as we go further. So on the next slide, what are the different multi-core software approaches? There's many of them. I've got a few of them here. One is kind of, like I mentioned before, a system consolidation where I may be going from, say, a board with multiple processors to a chip and using virtualization to do that consolidation. That's, many people are motivated to do that to save both power and space. The process-level parallelism, again, usually supported by a symmetric multiprocessing operating system like Linux, good for improving responsiveness in certain application spaces like networking. And then on the application-level parallelism side, this is where we might have more threaded code, something with a concurrency abstraction layer. I'll talk a little bit more about that layer later. That's primarily at that level of parallelism, the next level down, it's all about improving performance as well as addressing the power. So those are just kind of high level. We'll go into a more detailed example, but that's kind of a survey of the different types of parallelism and both the hardware and the software architectures that would support those types of parallelism. The next item on the agenda then, let's just kind of dive into some of the details. We'll talk about some exploration and verification now. I'll start with, on the next slide, talking about sequential to parallel migration. Now, this is an interesting area because many people are trying to do it. There's a large amount of sequential code out there, and one of the challenges is migrating that sequential code over to a multi-core processor. So the sequential to parallel migration is a popular challenge amongst many developers. So in the high level process flow, based on your requirements or your existing code, what's shown here is a step of doing sequential analysis of that software, and then doing an iterative amount of exploration, and I'll go through an example of that, analysis, design, coding, and verification, and then into an iterative phase of tuning, and then that may iterate back to the exploration phase. Now, this doesn't look at first glance much different than maybe what you're used to in other, embedded software development processes. But there are some specific things we need to look out for from a multi-core perspective. We have to be able to identify possible parallelism. I'll give you some hints about that. Once you identify it, decide how to exploit it. And then you have to verify both the functional correctness as well as the performance. And in some cases, if you don't do that right, believe it or not, going to multiple cores, you could actually get worse in performance. if you don't follow certain steps. And so you iterate through these sequence of steps. You'd like to do it from high impact downward. So you like to, you know, find the big hitters from a performance perspective, for example, and go after those first. One of the big things about, and studies have been done on this, and a lot of people have been talked to about this, is when you're going through a process like this, what many developers do is they have a goal for where they want to get to on performance, and once they achieve that goal, they don't keep going onwards. They you know, it's a time to market issue, so they'll ship the software once they meet their performance goals. And this is important because you don't want to get into what's called excessive optimization, or even what's called premature optimization. And so it's about knowing when to, you know, kind of when to stop. Okay, so that's sequential to a parallel migration. What we want to do in this sequential to parallel migration is start from a working sequential code base, explore, tune, and really move from stable state to stable state. We don't want to break anything. The key message here would be keep each step simple and verifiable. Don't go off on a long, complex, catch-all conversion with a big bang test at the end. It's got to be very iterative. Otherwise, you get yourself into trouble. You have to start backing things out again. So let's talk about sequential analysis. With sequential analysis, this is, again, you're probably starting with optimized software. You want to ensure that you've got, you know, certain things are in place. Libraries are thread safe. I'll talk about that in the example. That can prevent you from breaking things as you migrate over to parallel. You have to profile to understand your program structure and identify hotspots, you know, look for performance bottlenecks. There are tools available for doing this. You know, we have some tools inside of Freescale that allows you to do this. There's some other very good tools out there in the marketplace, like Critical Blue, that allow you to do a lot of this type of analysis and tuning. But find a tool if you can. There are many out there. Find one that you like and use that to help you during this sequential analysis phase. You really want to first understand the code performance as well as the structure. So that's why we're doing this first, profiling it, looking at the call tree, finding the right level of granularity where you want to try to introduce some parallel programming constructs. Keep in mind Amdahl's law. The serial code is going to limit your performance gains, and so you need to understand that as well, too. You don't... many cases I've had questions on why do I go from, say, one core to four cores and I don't get my 4x speed up. You need to look and understand your sequential code limitations as it applies to Amdahl's law and focus on the largest chunks of execution that will get you to your goals as quickly as possible. So let's move on and talk about exploration. This is that first phase there where I showed you where it's iterative. We're going to look for different parallelization strategies, and there are several of them, and we'll talk about some of them. You want to do a relatively quick pass through this analysis design, coding, verification, do quick iterations, looking for some of these opportunities. Now, at this point in time, you want to favor simplicity over performance. Don't try to go all the way too early. We're going to try to do the right partitioning first. before we try to tune it up, which is at the end. Of course, verify each iteration. And the big thing in this phase is focusing on some of the key things that really destroy performance, that is dependencies, data dependencies, things like this. We have to do the right levels of decomposition. And even if, depending on what type of parallelization strategy you're going to take, and for example, you may be interested in using a technology like pthreads or maybe OpenMP. These are different kind of concurrency abstraction layers. Make sure you start out, I would favor simplicity. In other words, if you're familiar with these different technologies, OpenMP is a great kind of prototyping technology. You can start there first. Even if you want to go and tighten up with pthreads, you know, maybe start with OpenMP. So these, more on this later, but right now we want to try to favor simplicity, you know, over, you know, performance and complexity. So then the next slide, we'll move on to tuning. This is the next iterative phase. This is where we're going to identify more specific performance-related issues and then fix them. The common ones that I've seen have been things like thread stalls, excessive synchronization. Sometimes we do this to help try to overcome some data dependencies and data races, and we go too far, and we end up with excessive synchronization. Cache thrashing, I'll talk about. That can be a really big performance killer. And so the iterative approach and experimentation is really going to be the approach in the tuning phase. Again, all tuning is an iterative type of activity, and there is some experimentation that goes along with it. So, again, nothing totally new from developing any single core type application here. We're just going to look for a few different things in the multi-core world when we get into this tuning phase. A few things that are different, making sure we don't have too many threads per the number of cores, other types of locking mechanisms and things like that, and we'll get into this when we go into the example, which, speaking of which, let's go to the next slide. We'll look at this image processing example. I've chosen this one because it's relatively, it demonstrates a lot of the challenges and techniques, if you will, to get from to get a parallelized application using an iterative nature. So in this image processing example, we're going to focus on the key algorithmic stages. There's three of them, essentially a three-stage pipe, as you can see here, correct, which is basically a just pixel range type of an operation. The smoothing function, we're going to filter for noise. And the detection phase, where we essentially do an edge detection operation. Those are the three kind of primary phases of the pipeline that we'll talk about in this example. The and this code fragment that I'm showing you, if you look look down there, just under the unpack, we have the three basic fragments, three functions called in sequence, correct, smooth, detect. We're going to do this on this image, at least in this first example, stepping by columns. We'll also, in order to try to leverage our memory utilization as effectively as possible, we use ping pong buffers for the input and output buffers. And we use the void star there, that function signature, just to help us with the marshalling and unmarshalling of parameter arguments for those functions. So that's kind of I'll call that kind of the starting sequential type of function we'll look at. If you go to the next slide, first step then is sequential analysis. With sequential analysis, you know, we we look at where we're spending our time. In this particular case, if you do the analysis, first of all, each function is very is going to be relatively easy to parallelize. There is a constant amount of work per pixel in this particular algorithm, but there's a lot of different, there's a variation in the amount of work per function. As you can see there, smoothing function really takes up a lot of time. So obviously an issue, we can probably do something with that. We'll see if we can maybe use multiple threads or do something there to help parallelize that. Each pixel needs to be computed independently in this algorithm. There's also a good opportunity, therefore, for data parallelism. And so let's kind of look at what the process would be to kind of decompose this and move it along down the process. So the next slide, exploration, here's where we literally explore different parallelization strategies. Like I mentioned before, you know, you may want to go towards a your goal might be to parallelize with as little work as possible. In that case, you may choose an approach, a concurrency abstraction layer like OpenNP to help you with this. It's good for that. It's a good prototyping approach. Or you may want to choose fine-tuned control for parallelism. In that case, you may decide you want to use p-threads, but it kind of depends on exactly what you're trying to do with your project. Are you trying to develop a demonstration very quickly? Are you trying to really tune an application and get it to market as a product? So it kind of depends on what the ultimate goals are when you're going through this process. But during this exploration phase is where you explore these different parallelization strategies. Again, step one, favor simplicity over performance. You want to make sure you don't break anything as you go through these iterations. And this is where you kind of focus on those dependencies and do that decomposition. So if you go to the next slide, the data dependency analysis, this is just showing you what I mean when I say, you know, watch for data dependencies. Now, these might exist on your parallel application, but they get amplified in some cases when you go to a multi-core type of an implementation. And the thing about data dependencies is that they limit parallelism because they force execution order. There's there's several of these, three of them really, that are very well known, I guess, relatively well known. The read after write, as you can see on the left there, the variable A, you've got a, there's a dependency there that's going to force execution order. In the middle, the read after write, or WAR, this is where you have, you know, this is an example of an instruction where an instruction requires a value that is later updated, again, highlighting the variable A here. You can see how it's used and then needed. It's going to be updated later on. You've got to force execution order there. And then on the right, the write after write, normally you see this when the ordering of instructions affects the final output of a variable. Again, you can see A there being written to twice, and that's also going to force a dependency in an order, a strict order of execution. So there's three main types, but you need to analyze your code to see where these critical dependencies are. And, you know, can you remove them, or do you have to honor them? These types of parallel dependencies are usually not so local. They usually exist between tasks or iterations. So, but you still do need to do a little bit of analysis to make sure you don't have any of these. Again, there are some tools out there that can help you do this. But important from that you identify these data dependencies early. If you do that, you can. Let's move on to the next slide, parallel decomposition. I mentioned this earlier. We have data and task or functional decomposition, and I'm showing you that in this little image processing example. So task and data, if we took the task approach, we can take the image and we can do four independent functions on that image. We can do those at the same time across different cores. If we take a data approach, we can take that same image and we can cut it into four slices. And then we can filter those slices at the same time. And even though there may be a few dependencies around the edges of that image, we can take care of that with a little bit of glue code. So two approaches, two different types of decomposition, and we can actually look and explore each one of these, maybe even use both to see whether we can see what kind of performance we can get in a multi-core type of environment. So on to the next slide, we have to consider also decomposition granularity. Mainly what this is saying, by granularity, we want to pick the right chunk of work and parallelize that. So for example, in this image processing, it's probably a pixel is probably too small, but a chunk of data or a bunch of pixels in the right order probably would be the right level of granularity, but we have to look at it because you don't want to go too small because you'll spend a lot of overhead on each chunk. You don't want to go too big because it might blow out your cache. So you want to choose the right granularity when you decompose this to expose these parallelization opportunities. You can, during this exploration phase, you don't have to do any detailed analysis. Don't overthink it. Because again, you can iterate on this and tweak it up over time. This is another place where good tools would help, like tools from us, from Freescale, from Critical Blue, others out there. It really helps as you go through these iterations. You don't want to hardwire, by the way, the chunks, whatever chunk you decide on from a scalability perspective. Don't hardwire what you're doing. Allow that to scale because as you go towards, if you go from 1 to 2 to 4 to 8 cores, you don't want to be in there having to redo all that stuff. So try to make it scalable as much as possible. And then you also want to make sure, based on the platform you pick, that your data is going to fit inside your memory subsystem. Otherwise, you'll get thrashing and things like that. Okay, so on to the next slide. So implementation. So some good practices. You're probably familiar with these. Code incrementally. Code in order of impact. Highest impact first. Make sure it scales. Don't do too many things at once so that you don't break things and have to start backing things out. Okay, so verification. We have to make sure this stuff works after we make these changes. So on the verification side, the key thing to keep in mind here is when you parallelize, although you're dealing with some similar issues as far as debugging code to a sequential application, parallelization introduces new sources, not necessarily new types, but new sources of errors. So it's a different kind of dimension we're looking at here. For example, you've probably all heard of data races and deadlock. So nothing new as far as the terminology, but when you parallelize, you could expose new areas of data races and deadlock. And this is what you need to look at and why you go through this verification step. Any unsynchronized access to shared memory can introduce data races, like what's shown there on the left. Data races, you solve these by adding locks that protect the invariant, whatever you're changing. Unfortunately, when you introduce locks, they can have their own hazards, most notably deadlock, like on the right. Now, deadlock occurs during certain conditions where you have access to a resource that's exclusive. A thread is allowed to hold only one resource while requesting another one, like the picture shows, and no thread is willing to relinquish a resource that has been acquired. So there's conditions that affect deadlock, and you have to, if you break those conditions, then you can eliminate some of this deadlock. So it's a problem that you've probably discovered in other areas of embedded computing. when you go to multi-core, you can expose this in other areas, new sources of these same conditions, and you have to make sure you check for these. Again, I'll go, you know, there are tools that can help you identify these types of conditions and really help you out there as well, but it is a step you have to go through. So the next slide, verification. We're going to, again, reuse our sequential tests, run those to keep that kind of golden model on the side. You like to always have that, and then check for these different types of parallelization errors by stressing the system if you need to. Keep in mind that the execution of ordering between threads is unpredictable, and we have to have some partial order ensured to make sure we have proper execution. So let's go to the next slide, and we'll talk about this image processing example again. This is just the same slide I showed before. You can see the three sequential functions at the bottom there, the correct, the smooth, the detect. So now if we move on to the next slide and try some data parallelism, we'll call this try number one, where now what we're going to do here is partition, create a number of threads, specifically one per core. If you look at the code, you can see there that we've introduced these concepts of pthread, create, and join. That's going to allow us to create these threads. The pthread create starts a new thread in the calling process. The join function suspends execution of that calling thread until the target thread terminates, or if it's already terminated. But those are what spawns off the threads onto the different cores. So now we can get into kind of a parallel method of operation. As you can see there, the fork, looking at the picture, the fork, and then we do two threads of correct, smooth, and detect, and then we join at the end. Let's call this the first try. It gets us kind of close. You can see at the picture in the upper right. We still got a couple issues, but it's something that we could, it's iteration number one, if you will. On the next slide, well, what caused this kind of blinds in the data like this? Well, in this particular case, without going into a lot of detail, it was one of those data dependencies that was introduced. We had a functional error. We had a read after write dependency here, so a race condition. And so now we have to, basically what was happening is the smooth was reading before it was written by the correct operation. And so we have to fix it. It was the way we were doing our forks and joins. We were doing it across multiple functions, and we just didn't preserve that data dependency. So if you go to the next slide, the second try, now the fix for this is we essentially finish each function completely before calling the next one. The way we do this, if you look at the code now, is we've done three pthread operations that spawn the functions correct, smooth, detect, and then join to bring them back together after they're completed. These are three separate fork joins. This is one possible solution. There are others. This is one way to fix the problem by ensuring some of that alignment between these threads so that one doesn't finish faster than the other and ends up with one of these data dependencies. So if you go to the next slide, what happens is functionally this is correct. This worked. Interleaving columns, the way we did it over columns, probably wasn't great on this target system as far as a data locality, but that's something that we could deal with. We can deal with here in just a moment when we tune it. At the next slide, on the third try, we have a strategy of now going into a pipelined architecture. So this, we switch to a task parallel implementation using a pipeline where we can put more pixels into the queues and we can manage those queues with a little extra code and move into a more pipelined operation. And that also would work. This is another software architecture, and it's another strategy, and it's something we can try to see if that works or whether we get additional performance improvements. If you go on to the next slide, the result we end up with improved throughput, but not necessarily a latency. The latency is still the same, but like any pipeline, the throughput, overall throughput, improves, and I'm trying to show that in the diagram there at the bottom. Now one thing we could do is to exploit more potential parallelism is look at data parallelism, and that's what we'll do. That's what we'll end up doing next. So the exploration results on the next slide is just summarizing for you some of the things we've done, and we'll pick ultimately a strategy that works for us after iterating, and then we move on to performance tuning, which is the next agenda topic. And I want to just quickly say a few words on this because I know we're short on time, but in the tuning phase on the next slide, this is where we really look at tightening up on performance. Again, it's an iterative type of an approach that can help us but really drive performance improvements if we again, take an iterative, incremental approach through the operation. So if you go on to that data parallel slide, you can see that we're starting from that same place we finished before, where we had, it looks very similar to what we did before with the column orientation and the three different pthread spawns. This is okay, but we have to look at the performance impact, and so we have to measure that performance. And so on the next slide, you can see that the results look pretty bad. As a matter of fact, we got worse going to a parallel architecture. And the reason for this, and it's not too surprising, is that we end up with a usage pattern, memory usage pattern degradation, something that's very common in multi-core called false sharing. And so false sharing is a variance where multiple different independent or cores try to operate on independent data in the same memory region. We can fix it. It's not too difficult to fix. We can go with a row ordered. And if you go to the next slide, I'll just go through this very quickly. The row ordering now exploits localization, cache localization, much more. And if we go to that approach, this is pretty common to look. Go to a different type of an ordering in your memory subsystem. This ends up actually really working out well for us. On the results slide, you can see by looking at that bar chart, going with a this row-oriented approach, very good localization of data, and you can see the performance scales almost linearly through the cores, which is excellent. It's kind of getting towards Amdahl's law. And then on the next slide, just a little bit more about data locality. Cache hits and misses are a really big problem in multi-core as well, so we need to be aware of that. Data locality, nothing new compared to sequential. You're all familiar with how caches operate and data locality issues, so that's not a really big change, only with parallel or multi-core. It could be made worse depending on the multiple cores accessing the same cache lines. And then I'll say just a few words. If you just go to the fourth try on my data parallelism example here, by slicing things a little bit differently, we have gotten much better performance. And however, we can overdo it. If you go to my fifth try and look at that code. I think this is on slide 49. Look at how complex that code has gotten. And the key question there is, I can get more performance by tweaking and tweaking and tweaking. At what point is it not even necessary to do that? That is the key, kind of the key question here. And so there we go. I've gone through the last few slides fairly quickly, but I wanted to give you an idea of how that would work for tuning memory. So a better approach to multi-core, just a few words on some of the processors that Freescale has. We have a lot of power architecture processors, and Layerscape, our new architecture, is also multi-core, very software aware, we scale from low power up to high performance processors, so a whole portfolio of those. And we also have a pretty advanced ecosystem. So on the next slide, we do have a lot of partners, a lot of development tools, and with this ecosystem for tools and operating systems and middleware, a lot of the things I alluded to and the processes I talked about, we can actually make that more efficient, enhance that, get you started and to your goals more quickly by using some of the tools available and some of our partners with some excellent technology. So anyway, on to the next slide. Get your design started today. Please contact either Arrow or one of the Freescale FAEs to get access to these technologies and tools, and they'll help you get going very quickly. It looks complicated, but actually, if you follow the right process on the summary slide, if you follow the right process and you take it slow and you iterate and you don't overcomplicate it, it's actually not that bad, and there's a lot of great tools to help you that support you during the process, during the life cycle. Definitely try to take advantage of some of those, you'll be successful. It's getting better every day. I'm very confident that with the processors out there today, the ecosystem, the tools, you're going to be successful with your multi-core processing. So I want to thank you for giving me the time to talk today. There's a few minutes for questions, Kurt. I'll send it back to you.
Very good. Thanks, Rob. Yeah, we'll try to hit right into the questions. We will be staying over by a couple, 3 minutes. If you can continue to join us, the audience, please feel free to do that. We'll try to hit as many of these questions as we can. Here's a question about tools specifically that can be used to check for deadlocks. I know you talked about some of the tools that are good profiling tools on multi-core. How about runtime deadlock identification and things like that?
Yeah, there are some tools out there that in the commercial space that can help you with some of that. We've actually done some of the deadlock detection as well as race detection. Starting with some of the race detection, we've used tools from Critical Blue. They also help identify areas of code where you may have deadlock. So, you know, I'd start there, and there's also some internal tools that we have, but I'd start with a Critical Blue to help you with something like that.
Okay. Very good. We talked about that. Let's see. What kind of scaling do you expect when you make your code multi-threaded? Essentially, let's say you take a P2020 versus a T2040. This is an interesting question in terms of, you're scaling cores and you're scaling performance on each core and maybe some assist. I know you'd mentioned Amdahl's law where you can only be as fast as your slowest sequential segment, but can you kind of make a general statement on as you scale cores and performance on cores, what you think the scaling would be like?
Yeah, it's a really good question when you talk about, you know, Amdahl's law just talks about kind of a generic cores and scaling just numbers of cores. But when you throw into that equation other processing elements that do acceleration, for wow. example, and as those accelerators, you know, change between, say, processor families, what you have to do to really estimate from one device to another the performance scaling you can apply Amdahl's law roughly to some of the code that you expect to be the same running on each of the cores. Then you have to have a multiplicative factor based on the core performance and frequency if you're going from one core to the next. And then what you can do also is take out the code segments that you expect to run on an accelerator or accelerators, and that should be factored out of that equation or factored in differently because it's going to run that sequential code that you're mapping to that accelerator probably more quickly. And so there's kind of an algorithm that you can apply. I wouldn't start off with just using a kind of a blind Amdahl's law when there's that many parameters at play, new accelerators, new core frequencies, et cetera.
Right.
I would do, you may want to start there as a first order approximation, but I would go a little bit deeper and do some benchmarking to look at some of the other potential differences. For example, software architecture makes a big difference. If you have data coming in off of a VETSEC, how that data gets distributed to the different cores can make a really big impact on overall system performance. And so you need to look at the architecture, the software architecture of the new system you want to develop, as well as these other hardware factors. Amdahl's law doesn't take a lot of that into consideration. So you need to do a little bit of benchmarking to get some data on that.
Right. In terms of the overhead information, overhead information with synchronization, memory thrashing, cache thrashing, which you talked about, when you're idling, do these tools cover those things as well? And how do you diagnose or what are the warning signs when you're cache thrashing? That's kind of a silent thing in the background that, you know, maybe more traditional tools for real-time operating systems and interrupt latencies and things like that handle?
Yeah, so they do, and that's what we use. One of the things I didn't speak a whole lot about was a lot of the, those tools will help, and a lot of these multi-core processors have some pretty sophisticated on-chip debug architectures as well. Those Core IQ processors I alluded to have a pretty extensive debug architecture that provides a lot of the visibility into a lot of the nooks and crannies, not just in queries like your cache, but also in the use of different peripherals. So utilizing that debug architecture and some existing tools, you can get cache information as well as other performance-related information across your interconnect and your peripherals and your accelerators, and it becomes a system view that you need to take here, not just a core view. I think you really have to look at it as a system. And so these debug hooks give you a lot of that information as well.
Right. Okay. Here's a really interesting question. As far as parallelizing software goes, there's much of a push towards side effect-free functional language. This person cited Google searching is largely based on a Lisp style map-reduce approach. Applying these kinds of concepts and things to the embedded space, do you think it may evolve toward, are we going to keep using CC++ and beyond, or are we going to evolve to a more functional language that's better suited toward multi-core designs and embedded?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. So, will functional programming languages, for example, finally have its day in multi-core? This has been debated for so long, it's still being debated, to be perfectly honest with you. I think there's some that believe it might be the right time for things like functional programming languages, Haskell-like languages that can be used for programming these types of devices. Others will say that'll never happen. It's an interesting debate. Most of the panels and discussions I've been involved in, this discussion comes up, and there's no clear trend one way or the other. I do think there'll be more thought put into it now, I think, now that we're getting into massively, many, many core type processors. But in the back of my mind, I'm a little bit cynical because we've been discussing some of these topics for so long.
Right.
So to be honest with you, we'll see where the industry decides to take it.
Right.
very interesting question.
Here's another one. We'll have to wrap up here quick, but let's get to this one. He mentioned on the presentation there's a lot of customization of code. What about general data processing? What if you just find out the data model you've created for your system when you parallelize it is wrong for multi-core? What do you do then?
What if you find out your data model is wrong?
Like, what if it just doesn't lend itself well to parallelizing your code?
Oh, okay, yeah. So in some cases, yeah, that is exactly what happens, and then you have to do more. You may have to do more aggressive steps or more significant steps to break up some of those data structures or do some other algorithmic transformation. The example I showed you was, relatively straightforward, taking an image and being able to easily partition that. It was easy. But in some cases, it's much more difficult, and that does become a bottleneck at times. There are some other types of things you can do to refactor to get you slightly more efficient structures that can be leveraged, but you don't want to do things like duplicating data and doing things like this where you can end up getting yourself into really big trouble.
Right.
So there are some guidelines around there that that need to be followed as well, because otherwise, if you're not careful about that, you can end up with systems that really don't scale very well. So in some cases you will be forced and limited by some of the specific requirements on your data patterns and things like that.
Right. Okay, well, very good. Unfortunately, that brings us to the end of our time here for the eCast. Thank you very much, Rob, for sharing your insights and really providing a quality, detailed description of parallelizing and load balancing, performance tuning, multi-core designs. We at Open Systems Media and Rob also want to thank all of you for attending today's eCast and contributing those excellent questions remotely. This eCast will be posted online at the URL shown on your screen within 24 hours, and an audio-only podcast will also be made available. You can do a web search with the keywords embedded space e-cast and find all of Open Systems Media eCasts available for download as MP3s. Thanks for attending, and have a great day.